The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 533 for Monday, December 29th, 2014. I don't even know what we do here, John. You know, I've done, how many times have I done this intro? Probably 300, right? Because there was a time when I was doing the intro.
Approximately.
Yeah. So 300 times. I have no idea what I'm supposed to do now. So I'm just going to play the song. And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, your tips, your cool stuff found. We share all that. We answer it. We share our own stuff, tales of woe, cool things we've found together. The goal is to learn a whole lot new about the Mac. One of these days, I got to listen back to the show and figure out what it is that I do in the intro so that I don't forget. That's really, it's both embarrassing and funny. This episode is sponsored by Lynda at lynda.com, lynda.com/MGG for a 10-day, that's 10 days, free trial of their award-winning and really well-done videos. So check it out, lynda.com/MGG. We will talk about that later in the show. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, for the last time this year, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here, watching my esteemed colleague Dave Hamilton crash and burn for the last episode of the year.
Yeah.
Is, John F. Braun.
Yeah, I haven't even started drinking yet. I have no idea what caused me to fall off my game there, but I definitely did. So there we go. So we might as well just get through, we go into this and get through this and then get past it. John, we talked last week and the show happened just after I had dropped off my iMac for diagnosis and repair, or actually for repair. I guess where we left it last week was I had dropped it off that morning and they had called me and told me it's the power supply. It's a $106 fix and we're going to take care of it. We'll call you when it's finished. Right. I think that's where we left. That's where we left off.
Right. This is your 2011 27 inch, I believe.
That's correct. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So,
okay. So that was their initial diagnosis. All right. Sounds good.
But
sounds
as good.
How'd that work out?
Well, as you said during the show, sometimes what you have to do is test your theory to find out that you were wrong. And you know, so it got to be like 9 o'clock at night on Sunday. We finished the show. I still hadn't heard from them. I thought this is kind of weird if they have the machine open. You know, that's kind of a, you know, it's not a big deal to repair that or to replace that. So I called them up like 9 o'clock at night. Hey, they said, I'm glad you called. So we replaced the power supply and it's still having problems. So we think it's the motherboard, but we're not sure. We want to run it through a series of tests overnight. I'm like, okay, fine. You know, so, they run it through their tests. It comes to be about 2 o'clock the next day. Still haven't heard from him, so I give them a call. Yeah. Glad you called. So, it's the motherboard. Like, okay, well, what did the tests reveal? Because I'm just, you know, a geek, right? This is what we do. So I like to know the answers so I can share and hopefully it helps people, but also for my own edification. And I'm like, you said you were going to run some tests overnight. Was it the test that told you this? Yeah. It was the test. Like, okay, fine. What's the damage on a motherboard? Like, let me look that up. 5 minutes go by. They come back. Yeah. Okay, great. It's $737 for the motherboard. I had already done the math. I knew what the machine was worth, which was about $1,300. And I figured, okay, fine.
I'm close.
Yeah. Right. But it's, you know, fine. I said, will you charge me? What's the story with the power supply? Will you charge me for that? No. Okay, great. Will you leave the new power supply in there? Yes. Okay, great. So now for $737, I get a new motherboard and a new power supply and they've done all the work. Great. You know what? Go ahead and do it. So, you know, it gets to be about 9 o'clock again. Phone hasn't rang. I call them up. Hey, glad you called, they say. This is getting to be, you know, wash, rinse, repeat here. So, yeah, we put the new motherboard in. We're seeing some odd results on our test. we think maybe we're going to take it apart again and like reseat the connectors on this new motherboard. I'm like, okay, but you and I both know that that's not going to do anything, right? And they're like, actually, yeah, you're probably right. I'm like, okay, well, I said, when I checked it in, the guy that I checked it in with said, like, immediately assumed it was the graphics card because there's a recall on those on this. There's an or a warranty extension on those. And actually it was a, she said, yeah, you know what? There is, we're going to try a new graphics card. So the next day, they call me and they're like, good news and bad news. It is that putting the new graphics card in fixed it. I'm like, great. Awesome. But you know, the motherboard that we put in is a little bit flaky. So we actually, we're getting some weird sensor readings. We want to swap your motherboard again, but we don't have one. So it's probably not going to be here. It might be here Wednesday, which was Christmas Eve. If not, it's going to be here Friday. And then we got to test it overnight. So you're probably not going to hear from us until Friday or Saturday. I'm like, you know what? That's fine. It's what's the damage now? What are we talking about here? They're like, oh, well, we're going to replace the power supply, the motherboard and the graphics card, but we're only going to charge you for the part or parts that were actually required to fix the problem. I'm like, wow, that's awesome. Cause my motherboard, my Ethernet port on it had stopped working, which we talked about over the summer, or it stopped working at gigabit speeds. And so it was like, this is awesome. Great. So, Saturday I get a call. Yep. You're good to go. All we're going to charge you for is the motherboard. It's $236. Like, woohoo. Great. Awesome. Or $265, $36, $236 plus like $40 labor. This is great. So I go down there and they show me the receipt and it's like $1,100 worth of parts and labor. But they say, don't worry, we're only going to charge you this, and which they did. And I put the thing in the car. It's the computers at or the Apple store that I was going to was the Rockingham Mall in Salem. So I put the computer in the car and we go back in the mall and we had lunch and we shopped around a little bit or whatever. And as we're finishing lunch, just about to leave, I pull up the receipt, John, on my phone, because that's, you know, they email you the receipt, and I'm looking at it, and it shows the three parts that they replaced, and one of them is a part for a Core i5 3.1 gigahertz motherboard. My computer had started the week with an i7 3.4 gigahertz motherboard. It's like, oh.
You've been robbed.
Yeah. So I went back in. They were, once they sort of accepted their, they were fine. The guy up front was a little bit, I get the feeling that the people up front in the Apple stores, like the people that assign you to a genius or assign appointments, don't have a whole lot of leeway. Because he was saying, well, you know, we might be able to get you an appointment to check it back in later tonight. I'm like, no, we're going to check it back in right now. We're not going to wait till later tonight. He's like, well, okay, all right, well, we can check it in, but you know, it's probably going to be another week before we get to look at this. We're really backed up. Like, again, no, you're backed up because my computer just moved to the front of the line, right? I mean, you can't, you stole from me. Everybody, once the geniuses got involved and once management got involved, which they sort of did on their own, I didn't have to make a big stink or anything. Everything was fine, but this poor guy up front was a little bit unsure of how to handle things, but we did get it checked in. And, then last night I finally went and picked it up with the right motherboard and of course the new power supply and graphics card. And, for the most part, things are fine. Things are totally fine. When you get a new motherboard, things change on the computer. So there was a little bit of reset up and things like that. iCloud keychain got reset. Find My Mac got reset. SMS forwarding got reset, right? A lot of these things kind of happened. My reservation for my IP address obviously got reset because I was moving from the Thunderbolt port back to the new Ethernet port in there. But everything works. It's great. Works outstandingly. For $266, I got a new power supply, motherboard, and graphics card, and a 90-day warranty on all three of those parts, even though I only had to pay for one of them. That's not bad. It charmed life, right?
Yeah, no, they tend to do the right thing. I'll have to see how things worked out with my iPhone. As you recall, I had a battery issue, Dave, and it seemed to re-rear its ugly head.
Hey, before you hijack, though, there are some things that I learned through this process that I want to share.
Go.
When calling the store, the first time I called the store, it says, if you want to talk to a technician or Genius Bar, press 1. Well, I did that. I got routed to some nationwide call center, and they didn't have any answers for me. And they actually put me back in touch with the store, but the connection had so much lag, I had to have the store call me back. But it took like 15 minutes to figure that out. So I never, if you have a computer in the Genius Bar and you need to ask them a question about it, do not choose the Genius Bar option. What I started doing was asking for a specialist, but as I learned further and further down the line, the best thing to do, as soon as it says, what are you here for, say the word manager. The word manager does not get you directly to a manager. You're not wasting a manager's time. You get directly to a specialist. You just saved yourself about 30 seconds worth of navigating and negotiating with the AVR system. So the word manager is the magic one. It gets you right to the person you'd get to normally if you get to a frontline human there. You can check online for your repairs at the Genius Bar, and they will tell you. Like on Saturday, I actually looked online to see if the computer was ready, and it was. I had not gotten an email from them. I had not gotten a phone call, but it did. It said it was finished online. I mentioned there was a warranty extension on that graphics card. I printed that out. They mentioned nothing about it when bill time came. I had printed out the details of that warranty extension, and I had also printed out my original sales itemization that showed that I had the graphics card that was listed. As soon as I asked them about it, they're like, oh, good call. Hang on, let me look. And they showed me that it actually did not fail the test that would qualify me for that. Yes, the board itself was bad, but it was bad in a different way. And I wasn't really going to complain about spending $260 to do all those three things, but I had to ask, right? And, you know, be your own polite advocate is kind of the thing there. You know, they're good people, and they appreciate it when you are too. One last thing, John, I asked them the trick, because the thing that really bothered me about replacing my own power supply in the beginning was getting all the dust off of that stupid screen. So I asked them, I'm like, how do you guys get the dust off? They're like, aha, we have a silicone roller that we roll on the screen and then roll on the glass on the backside of the glass. And then at the very last second, we blast it all with compressed air and then quickly put it on. They're like, it's not perfect. It's not perfect from the factory, but that's how they do it. Silicon rollers. So figured I would share that. I learned another valuable lesson, John, but do you have any questions about this one before I share my stupid lesson that I should have learned previously?
No, I think we're good.
Okay. Well, I had, there's two drives in that machine, right? It's a 256 gig SSD and then the 1 terabyte drive. It's essentially the same hardware that you get if you got a Fusion Drive iMac, but the 2011 iMacs, at least summer of 2011, was pre Fusion Drive from Apple. So my machine doesn't have a Fusion Drive. I could hack one in, but I don't want to. Because of that, I had partitioned the internal spindle drive, 250 gigs of that, to be a clone, which is great. It clones to that every night. But when there was a problem with the computer and it wouldn't turn on, I had no way of accessing my clone. So I have since learned I had Time Machine backups that I was able to restore from, and I worked all week just fine, and I was fine. But if you're going to bother to do a clone, follow my new advice, and that is make sure you clone to an external drive that you could plug into a different computer. It will pay off someday. And that's sort of one of those duh moments for me, but you got to learn sometime.
Sure.
You know what I mean, John?
No.
Hello?
No.
You find anything fun on Google while I was telling my story?
No, I'm chatting with our peanut gallery here. Chat with the peanut gallery, you may ask, Dave. Our chat room, which is at www.macgeekab.com/stream. You can not only hear us, but you can type in our IRC-based rockin' chat room here.
Nice.
Which is so much fun. So I was just multitasking because some people were asking me about my Wi-Fi issues, which is another thing that I still have an issue with. But But the other thing I wanted to offer, Dave, so you may recall, I claimed that I had a, or no, I did. I have a battery issue, and I think I still do with my iPhone 5S. I'm going to try something different, though. So as you recall, I convinced the nice people at my local Apple store, now in Trumbull, Connecticut, which is very close to me.
Oh, that's good.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah, because before, I mean, I either had to go to Stamford or New Haven, or there's one up in the, you know, up far north, and you know, they're all kind of inconvenient. But Trumbull is very close to me, so that's great. And, you know, they're very, very nice. You know, everybody was helpful, and they you know, did the work. So my phone was out of warranty for a month, and they said, okay, well, you know, all right, we'll replace it instead of charging $80, which is nice. What they were going to charge me. But then the problem started, and initially the problem. I thought, okay, that was it. We nailed it. It was a bad or failing battery.
Sure.
Because there was an issue with the iPhone 5, and they actually had, as you mentioned, Dave, they sometimes have warranty programs.
Yep.
And they did for the 5, but not the 5S. I entered my serial number, and it said, no, you don't qualify for a free battery replacement under this program. But it's happening again. Again, my phone gets to, you know, the symptoms. I thought the phone hanging, once it's fully charged, so if you fully charge it, especially doing a trickle charge, so the phone will be at 100% sometimes for hours before it starts going down. And I believe that's in general normal. And you told me that too, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But the thing is, it's still now, it's doing it again. When it gets to 20%, the phone powers down. And that to me is not normal. But then I looked online and I found some people giving additional advice. They're like, all right, one way to fix a lot of problems with your iPhone is to do a restore, you know, from iTunes. You restore basically, you know, wipes out everything, reloads the OS, and then reloads your apps from your backup, and everything's great.
Sure.
But then some people said, you know what? Sometimes things get so corrupted that what you got to do is a DFU restore, which I did not do. And I believe what that is a device firmware upgrade. I think this is a general term that's used not only for iPhones, but for lots of devices. USB devices, and that you can put them a mode where you say, okay, by the way, get ready to get your firmware reloaded. And I believe that's what this does. In addition to reloading the OS and your apps, it also reflashes or reloads the firmware. And I think it also clears out some registers and other things. In this case, I'm suspecting maybe the ones that have to do with the battery calibration. So we'll see if that works. So I did a DFU restore update. Which you got to, you know, I'll link to the article that I found that does this. And actually, you know, iTunes even recognizes this. It's like, oh, your phone's in restore mode. You want me to do this, right? And it's like, yep, sure.
Yeah.
So we'll see. Otherwise, this, you know, most of the repairs, including yours, I assume, repairs are warrantied for 90 days. So
that's
if that
correct.
Doesn't fix it, yep. Then I think I'm going to go back to them and say, okay, guys, you replaced the battery. It's still doing this. You know, you were nice to me and you did it for, you didn't charge me. Now, I don't know. Is the phone broken? Is it a bum battery? Because I've heard of people going through multiple batteries, you know, the multiple battery replacements or multiple motherboard replacements. Sometimes, who knows?
So yeah.
Hope I get this fixed. I mean, it's not the end of the world. I mean, I always have access to, you know, either a rechargeable battery pack or a power cord to charge it. But it's just, you know, kind of upsetting. First world problem that the phone dies at 20% rather than 0%.
Yeah.
Or 1%.
Yeah. Huh. That's interesting.
Yeah. We'll see what happens.
Yeah,
so yeah. It was an interesting article. Once I did some more research that someone said, hey, psst, you know, this may solve battery problems. It's happened before.
I'm curious, you know, yeah. I mean, maybe that's kind of like an SMC reset on your Mac, right? Or maybe that's part of what a DFU, I didn't think that. Because I hadn't thought about it, I didn't think that a DFU update did anything different from a restore other than allowing you to do a restore when your phone has no OS on it to begin with, right? You know, if you crater your phone somehow, the DFU mode, which is something you get it into by holding the right keys down at startup, will let you install firmware onto a phone that otherwise appears, you know, non-responsive. So,
right. Well, I suspect it's not just the fact that it's reloading firmware, but I think in addition to that, I think it's clearing out some lower level registers, which to me sounds reasonable.
Totally.
The battery calibration is broken. Doing a firmware thing that also clears out these registers, maybe it. And actually, I linked to an article.
Maybe the trick. Yeah.
If not, you know, again, it's, you know, first world problem. I mean, right. I still get decent battery life out of it. I mean, I think I get, you know, like most people, an iPhone 5 under normal usage, you may get, you know, a day or two before you have to charge it again. Is that reasonable?
That seems reasonable to me. Yeah.
I mean, the 6, I think, like you have the 6 or the 6
Plus.
No, you settled on the 6, right?
No,
and that just has a larger.
Yeah.
Okay. And that just has a larger battery, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the iPhone 5 has a 22 or something milliamp hour battery. So,
right.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
All right.
Yeah. But, I'm pretty sure.
Of course, I think the 6 and the 6 Plus have a larger battery. So you're going to get.
Yeah, a little bit longer.
Hopefully get, you know, more than a day or two.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I get 2 days of okay. decent usage. Yeah. And if I'm using it like a lot, then it's, I'm down to 30% at night. And so I charge it, you know, in 1 day. But,
okay.
That's good.
Well, I think you told me that, you know, especially with that, you know, fancy pants charger that we found there is that you charge at night.
I do. Yeah.
And you leave the sound on.
No, what doesn't matter.
You told me that with that charger. Well, we found this charger that claimed to shut off when it gets to 100%, which it seems to
do.
But then if the phone dips, then to 99 or 98, then I guess the phone buzzes or beeps or something.
Yeah. The phone buzzes or beeps depending on what mode it's in as it goes back on charge. It's just how it works. Yeah. Hey, I want to talk. I know we have some questions and some tips. Actually, we have some great tips. We have a tip. Yeah, yes, we have a tip that's I'm really excited about getting
it's
to.
It's a secret.
I know.
But we're gonna pull the covers off of it.
We will. But I do want to talk about our first sponsor, which is Lynda, lynda.com/mgg. And the folks at Lynda, you've probably heard me talk about this before here. They make training videos. They provide a training resource. Really, that's what it is. I mean, it's they probably have more courses online there than most colleges offer at the entire school, right? I mean, they just have all kinds of stuff. And it's fantastic how well produced all of these courses are. And some of them are quite long. Some of them are, you know, maybe an hour long. When you get a Lynda subscription, you have access to all of them. You can, and when you get this 10-day free trial from us with lynda.com/mgg, you get access for 10 days to all of them. There's no restrictions on which course you get to view. And in addition to it being a video course, and the video courses can take the form of simply an instructor, you know, lecturing, if the course makes sense for that. Maybe you've got a course on, I don't know, maybe some business course where you just need to hear someone's opinion on something or someone educating you on something. That's fine. To things like, you know, if you want to learn about GarageBand or Logic Pro or iPhoto or OS X or iOS, you see the screens of the app or the OS that you're being trained on. And that's super helpful. If you need to learn QuickBooks or, you know, anything, they've got it all. It's fantastic. They iPhone stuff. They do Android stuff as well. It just works. And in addition to that, there's also a transcript of the entire course that kind of runs. It's almost like the sing along with Mitch thing. For those of you that know what I'm talking about, and I'm even too young to know what I'm talking about, but that's okay. kind of highlights the words as it goes through. If you want to look at that, you can. Hide that so that it's not distracting, obviously, but you've got the transcript. You also have, you know, the course outline. And what's cool is the course, all the courses, even the long ones, are broken up into sections, and you can have it just roll from one section to the next, or you can have it auto stop at the end of a section. So, you know, maybe you're learning a new piece of software and you want to stop and say, oh, let me play a little bit. Okay. Got it. Now I want to move on. And so you can go at your own pace. Really excellent stuff. They've got, you know, iOS 8 training, mobile office training, how to kind of pull all that together and make it work. If you want to learn Swift, you can learn Swift online from Simon Allardyce, the guy I took that Swift class from, the same guy that I took it from at Mac Tech. You can do it for free, lynda.com/mgg. So go ahead, start your 2015 off right, learn something new. and have fun while you're doing it. And, you know, they've got their apps will stream to your iOS devices too. So you could have your iPad next to you while you're learning on your Mac and experimenting there. And you've got the course right there on your iPad. It's awesome. So check it out. lynda.com/MGG and make sure you thank them for sponsoring the show too. And for working with us to get you this 10 days free. So lynda.com/MGG. Thanks so much. All right, John, we'll go mostly in order here. I mentioned that I have two bootable drives inside my iMac, and that sort of threw the technicians for a loop too. And when I got it back, it was booting from the clone. And the reason was, not only had I reset the PRAM, but they had reset the PRAM. They had replaced the motherboard. So what that meant was the computer didn't know what disk to boot from. So it booted from the first one that it finds, which for whatever reason in that computer is the spindle drive. And one thing that's important to remember is make sure your Mac has a startup disk set. Your Mac, you can actually have your Mac set with no startup disk, and that's not necessarily a good thing. And Edward kind of went through an issue and had a similar problem. And you set your startup disk in System Preferences startup disk. It's very straightforward. If you have a startup disk set to a disk that is not connected to your Mac, you will see a gray screen on boot for a long time. I believe it's 45 seconds before your Mac will say, all right, that disk isn't going to come online. I'm going to just go look for whatever's there and then start up. So if you see that on your Mac, don't fret. It's just that your startup disk isn't set that your startup disk is set, but to something that your computer can't find.
Right.
Right.
So are you trying to say that this is stored in your PRAM?
Mm-hmm.
I think you just said that.
I did.
Want to make sure.
Yeah.
Because I think it leads to an interesting point that Edward brought up and that he brought up to us. He's like, you know, I recently did a major upgrade to my machine and happened to disconnect the battery. Well, what does that do with newer machines? Now, for older machines that have a CMOS battery, like my old trusty still in pieces MacBook Pro early 2008,
all computers have a CMOS battery. Laptops don't, but my iMac did.
You're correct. No, the newer Mac laptops do not.
Right. But desktop machines.
The older
do.
Ones like mine.
Yeah.
Correct. Right. And you've replaced it. Yeah. Mm. The little 3.6 volt little battery there. But at some point they abandoned that because my early my MacBook Pro early 2008 absolutely had one,
right,
which at one point failed. And usually, you know, it fails. Or you'll know that your PRAM has lost whatever it knew, because when your computer starts up, typically the first thing it'll say is, dude, it's not 1970, which is the default, I guess, epoch. Is the default time if it doesn't have a time source. It quickly fixes itself. But actually, I learned this when I got my, you know, when I upgraded my used new machine.
I just want to, there's a disconnect here, because Edward's problem was not that his PRAM got reset. In fact, Edward's problem was that his PRAM was not reset, and therefore his computer was looking for a drive that wasn't connected and forcing him to wait the 45 seconds. So the 45 seconds means you have a startup disk set, but it can't find it. That's where that is. If you don't have it set, it's actually going to boot quite quickly just from whatever drive it finds.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think I've also seen sometimes it'll try to do a net boot, which a lot of times most people don't have that set up, which is a way to boot a drive over the network. I think I've had it may not do that anymore. I know there was an option in the past. So
you can. Yeah. It will. Like, I watched them at the store, at the Apple store, do a net boot on my iMac. They just plugged it into Ethernet.
Oh, really?
They held down the option key. And that's how they did some kind of very quick diagnostics right out there. When I was checking the computer in the first time, was they did a couple of net booted diagnostics. But
okay.
Yeah.
So I think the default behavior, if things have been wiped, or maybe it's always, unless a drive is set, that I think most machines will try to do a net boot, which is they go on the network and they say, hey, anybody bootable out here? And,
right.
I think most people have never encountered that. You only find that, I think, in a, you know, support or enterprise environment. But
I would agree. Yeah. So just remember to set a startup disk. Good tips. Thank you, Edward, for the dialogue that got us there. All right, John, you want to take Sean for us here?
I think I'll take Sean. I'm not sure where this is going to go, but so Sean writes in and he says, "Hi, Dave, John, and Pilot Pete." I want to say hi to Pilot Pete too, wherever he may be piloting. And he says, "I've been listening to recent podcasts where you talk about battery care. I have always heard and have lived by running a rechargeable battery. Could be a laptop, iOS device, battery for a drill, etc. Oh, interesting. Down to zero and then charging it up again. However, it seems that you are not suggesting this. Rather than not wait until the battery is fully discharged to charge. Am I correct in this? If so, is this true for all types of rechargeable batteries?" All right. So number one, I think we want to clarify here that the battery technology we're going to be talking about is lithium ion, which I believe is pretty much the standard rechargeable battery technology in all rechargeable battery devices, whether they be a drill or a computer or an iPhone. Right, Dave?
Yeah, I've still got some drills that are NiCad, but, you know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then we have different issues, and maybe you have some lead acid batteries around. I don't know.
Right? I might. Yeah, I don't know. Who knows what I have,
John? I think those are probably in your car, right?
Yes. Yes, that's right. Yes, I do. Yeah.
But basically, I said to Sean, and I'd like your commentary, Dave. You know, I did some research on this, but I think what you're doing is best practice. Best practice being charge all the way up, including a trickle charge, and then run it all the way down. I would say on occasion that's a good thing to do. Maybe once a month, but I would say, and the thing is, I found something at Ars Technica which would argue that always running a battery all the way up and always running it all the way down is probably not the best strategy, and that their advice, and I've stuck to this as of late, and it hasn't seemed to have any negative side effects, is when I can, and not too frequently, I will run all the way up to 100% and all the way down. But if it's close to being fully charged or it's close to being fully discharged, I will let it go at that. I found numerous articles that suggested, again, they're saying don't always go all the way up and don't always go all the way down, because if you do that, that may not be the best thing. So that's all I'm going to say is the latest research seems to indicate what I say is not entirely insane.
It's not insane. I think it's...
But I want your input. I mean, do you believe that going all the way up and all the way down constantly is best practice all the time?
No, my religion says that you should never, with lithium ion stuff, especially running it all the way down just to charge it all the way back up is unhelpful at best. At worst, if you run a battery all the way down and for whatever reason have to leave it or forget and leave it there for too long, that battery will never come back to life. And that's true of your phone battery. That's true of your computer battery, right? I mean, that this is a problem with lithium ions. And based on what we've heard from kind of anecdotally from all of you, as well as what the what Jeff Lynch and the folks who and his partner who make fruit juice have told us, the running up and down thing is not necessary with the kind of the newer batteries. So I don't follow that at all. I don't know that I have ever intentionally run my battery all the way down and all the way back up. And my battery runs great. It's actually better than it ever has been in my now 4 year, almost, well, 3.5 year old, MacBook Air. So I don't think it's a bad thing if you happen to do it, but I certainly wouldn't. I don't advise going out of your way and doing it. But again, we're bordering on, you know, holy wars here, right? I mean, this is right. Well, I mean, it's, you know, we're talking about something very esoteric that can't really be proven. There's not enough evidence to say running it down and up once a month is absolutely the best thing for you. And there's not enough evidence to say it's the worst thing for you. It's basically unnecessary is what it comes out to be. So, that, you know, the real rule that I try to follow is keep the, and I know we leave neutrons out of this, John, but keep the electrons moving, because that, you know, either charging or discharging, but leaving it on charge all the time is absolutely the worst thing for it. And I don't think we disagree on that, or we could and well, have fun with it.
What about, you know, Dave, you're excluding the protons. I mean, they're a pretty positive bunch. And then you're not including the protons in this either.
No. Well, like I said,
why is that?
The last time we talked about this, neutrons, they have their own dance and protons have a cool name. So, you know, it's the electrons that we try to give a little, you know, we give them a little love.
All right. We're not even going to get subatomic here because then that just gets crazy.
Quark.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, some of the names of them. I still remember in my physics days, beauties and. Yeah, no, don't go there.
Are we getting close to talking about bosons, right? We're there. We're near
bosons?
There.
Bosons?
Right? No.
What is that?
Boson, B-O-S-O-N.
What is the term? I forgot the correct term there. It includes bosons, but what's the...
Oh, dude, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know where we're going with this, actually. We're at the end of my schooling knowledge.
Fermions.
Oh, fermions. Oh yeah. Right. Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'll give you that.
I know there was something going on for a while about bosons.
Well, the Higgs boson was discovered a couple of years ago.
Higgs boson. That's it. The Higgs boson.
Right.
Now, who's Higgs? I mean, what did he contribute to this? All right.
Well, he theorized.
Enough of that. That's
a boson existed, but couldn't prove it, and then somebody did. But
isn't that like Schrodinger's cat?
It's Schrodinger's boson is what it is.
Schrodinger's. Oh my gosh. All right. Well,
that's
all right.
Awesome.
So yeah. All right. So we got the physics geeks are going to shake their fist and write in angry letters to us because we just totally botched that. We don't know what we're talking about there, but it's fun to throw around the terminology and pretend that we do. But in that case, maybe we should go to, the next question there.
Yeah.
What,
go.
What do you think, Dave?
Yeah. Oh no, I agree. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. In this case, we're going to go to Alan. You think?
Yeah, go.
Alan's got a good one. And this is, you know, kind of like the last question, kind of pure speculation. And we have no idea what's going on here. But All right. So, hi, Dave and John. I have a head scratcher that I've been trying to figure out for a few days to no avail. I recently purchased an Inatech TPS reports, parentheses. I don't understand that reference. I know what a TPS report is, or at least the cover sheet. But
from the office.
Right. So.
Oh, yeah, no, well, some I office space. But office space.
But I don't understand why Inatech is related to them.
Isn't that the name of the company?
I'm sorry.
I think that was the name of the company.
It was? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I have to watch it again. Yeah. All right. So, but basically he said he got a new enclosure, Inatech brand USB 3.0, 2.5-inch hard drive enclosure. As an early Christmas gift to myself, I put a 1 terabyte Seagate drive in it to use as my new Time Machine backup. Outstanding. As I had recently converted my Mac Mini to a Fusion drive and now need more Time Machine space. The problem is this. When I plug the drive into my Mac Mini, my Wi-Fi connection immediately slows. I'm not near my router, so an RJ45 connection is out. Then the connection speed continues to slow, and eventually after about 20 or 30 minutes, the Mac Mini completely drops the Wi-Fi connection. It can't even see the SSID, which is the name of the base station. So I can connect to my guest network and get an IP address from the router, but the computer still won't connect to any web pages, including the router's internal configuration page. Ooh. I can ping just fine, be it the home IP, my router, or externally, such as Google, period. Network diagnostics will also tell me my internet connection is fine. Unmounting the volume doesn't help. However, the second I physically disconnect the drive's USB cable from the computer, all is well. I have no clue how this could be happening. I'm not sure there's any fix other than not using the drive. But any insight as to how a USB cable and or drive enclosure could muck about with the airport card? ? Merry Christmas and thanks for all you do. Well,
that's
you're welcome,
weird,
Alan. So, all right, it's weird. And the only thing I got to say, Dave, is based on my training as a kind of software, kind of hardware type of guy, it sounds like a power issue. Okay.
Okay. I'll walk down that path with you. Yeah, let's go.
In that when you plug in the drive, when you plug in and especially any drive, and I looked at this enclosure, and as far as I can tell, Dave, this enclosure is bus powered.
Okay. All right.
So the thing is, further supports drive enclosures. The right. So there are enclosures that are bus powered, which means the computer and the bus, in this case USB 3, is powering the enclosure. In other cases, an enclosure will be self-powered, in which case it's drawing less current from the computer. So the fact that he's plugging that in and all of a sudden everything kind of spirals downward would indicate to me that maybe there's a power issue within the computer itself. And this is not unheard of, Dave.
Nope.
Actually, you know, that was speculated with your situation there. So to me, it sounds like it may be a power issue. Now, how could you
And the airport card, the internal airport card, I believe, is connected to the USB bus. So that actually may either support I believe it is. I think if you look at the tree, it's there. I don't know the specific computer.
If we're talking a Mac Mini, I thought of this, believe it or not, Dave, I thought of this and I looked in system information.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to dive and then we're going to rise again here, but how do you get to system information? So how do you get there? Well, one way is you click on the Apple menu, hold down option and you will see system information. When it comes up, and I'm doing this live, folks, because.
Yeah, I'm there with you.
You know, this is exciting. And I do not see the.
Yeah, you're right.
At least on my Mac Mini, my current Mac Mini, I do not. No, I thought of that.
Bluetooth is there,
but I still
not
think
airport.
It's
right.
Correct.
Right.
Right. So I still think it's a power issue. If I saw the airport, so the airport card is on a different bus.
Okay.
But it's not to say that it's not
a
power issue. I'm not sure what bus it's on. It's on some sort of, and there are several types of buses, you know, as they indicated here, the things you'll see a lot of devices hooked on the USB. In this case, though, the airport card doesn't seem to be one of them, though it could still be a power issue.
No, that it's actually good that the airport's not on one of them, because that could be a USB issue. But if it's not, now it's a power issue. Right. I'm back to it. This helps support your case. So that's good.
Right. So the first thing I said is, you know, the thing is, if it's a power issue, you can determine the amount of power that something is drawing or should be drawing and how much it wants and how much your computer could supply. How do you do this? Well, you go to what I just mentioned here. You go to the system information, hardware, USB. When you see a device such as your enclosure, and it should be pretty clear what it is, it may be named, you know, Inatech, Ikatech, whoever these guys are. And you'll see that. And when you see that and you click on the device itself, you will see a couple of parameters. One you will see is current offered and I think current drawn. So you see some current figures there. USB 3 should provide, USB 3 is pretty beefy actually compared to USB 2 and others. USB 3 should provide you up to 900 milliamps. So the first thing I offered, we haven't heard back yet, was what do you see for how much power is available and how much is the device drawing? If it's approaching the maximum, then maybe the device is kind of wimpy.
Well, but here's the thing. Because you're the one that told me that devices lie. Right. So they will report to the system that they're going to sometimes draw less power than they actually draw. And the system has no way of knowing, no way of showing you what it's actually drawing if the device is lying. So for that reason, I spent my $12 and I bought a USB 2, USB 3 power meter, and you plug it in line. You plug one end into your USB port and then you plug the device in and it will show you what kind of power that that device is actually drawing. And that's super helpful. It has helped me in situations like this.
Very good.
Yep.
So the device could be marginal, could be malfunctioning. And yeah, as Dave said, as far as I know, the current that it reports it's drawing is burnt into the firmware of the device.
Right.
It's not actually measuring the actual current. I'm going to get to that in a moment. So But yeah, good point. You may want to get a USB power meter and see what's up with that.
It's,
you
know, totally
sure it's USB 3 compatible.
Totally helpful, not just for this, but also for telling how much your iPhone or your iPad is drawing on a charge, like all that stuff. I've used it countless times. It's like having one of those UV lights, John. You know, you got me hooked on having one of those. Now I can't possibly imagine not having a UV light around the house, like a little flashlight. It's awesome. Right?
I'm going to say another tangent and then we'll come back here. You know, we actually had someone warn us about direct exposure to UV, though I think for these little rinky-dink flashlights, I think that's probably not a concern. I think this was coming from someone that actually uses these in like in a professional laboratory environment. You don't want to constantly expose yourself to high-powered ultraviolet rays. That's bad for you.
That's right. It's like having a black light in a haunted house. I mean, it's not going to give you cancer, I don't think. So
I hope not.
Let's hope.
Yeah. All right. So. And to go to the next level. So number one, as you pointed out, Dave, the device could be lying. It could say, well, I only need this much power, but it's really drawing much more. So then you need one of these USB power monitors to figure that out. And that could be throwing everything out of whack. If it's drawing more power than the computer is used to, then these wacky things could happen.
Yeah, because
like your AirPort.
If it asks to draw more than the computer wants to deliver, then the computer will just say no. Right. But if it asks to draw a normal amount and then actually draws too much, that's where you can run into problems. So, all right, moving on. We're stuck in a loop here.
So moving on, how can you tell how much power is being drawn? Well, there are a number of tools here. And one of my favorites, Dave, is iStat menus. That's one. You got to pay a few bucks for it. I think it's well worth it, Dave. And it shows you all sorts of power. So the thing is, All Mac computers have numerous touch points where they tell you how much power is being consumed because the computer has to monitor this, because if things get out of control, it has to turn off or else it's going to burn your house down.
Right. Right.
Or have a spectacular failure. So iStat menus is one. Another is something called HW monitor, which is part of something called HW sensors. We will link to that. And that's another tool that will tell you about power consumption. So you may want to plug this drive in and just see, do any of these figures look out of whack? And I think actually HW sensors actually shows total power consumption, which you may want to see if it's more than your computer is equipped to do. And if it is, then oops.
All right, so I'm going to get us out of this loop because we've talked about way too many ways to determine power.
We're almost done.
No, we're done. So here's the thing. You can, the best way to test this would be to get a powered USB hub, plug it into your computer, and plug the drive into that hub. And this way, in theory, if the drive is going to draw too much power from something, it's going to draw it from the hub and not your computer. So that's going to answer your question as to whether or not this is a power issue, right? That really is the easiest way to isolate this out and yet still have the drive connected. If it does still do that, then I would recommend backing up the data off the drive, format the drive, connect it empty to the computer, see if that causes it. Now it might have been either the format of the drive caused the finder to like spiral, right? I mean, there's lots of different things it could be.
Come on, man.
Dude, I've seen it where you've got like a bad flash drive, a flash drive formatted the wrong way, and it causes, I haven't seen it cause AirPort problems, but I've seen it cause the finder to loop and all that stuff. So that's what you want to do. Right. You want to start isolating.
So thank you for mentioning the USB hub. That's something that I had in my response, but didn't mention. And finally, to wrap it up, power issues. One thing on any Mac, reset your system management controller.
Oh, definitely.
Because a lot of times if there are power issues, SFC reset can resolve them.
Yeah.
And that about wraps this up.
Yeah. That's a good SMC reset. That's a good idea. That's excellent. All right. Now, John, I'm excited. Because Paul sent us something that I thought was not possible.
It's a secret.
It's not really a secret, though, right? I'm not saving this for Cool Stuff Found. It kind of is Cool Stuff Found, but not really. He said, have you ever wanted to see all the available Wi-Fi networks around you and their relative signal strength and what channels they're on and all of that? Because Androids Android devices can run third-party apps and that can look at this data, but third-party apps on iOS cannot. And it sucks.
Well, that's a private API. You're not allowed to access that because that's a private API. Apple makes that pretty clear, right?
They do. And what sucks is then if you want to look around and see what channels like your neighbors are using, you have to use your MacBook Pro and walk around your house. Or worse, your iMac and walk around your house with like a big long extension cord. That's and run iStumbler, right? And iStumbler's great. But like Alf can't build iStumbler for iOS. Actually, let's be honest, Alf, I'm sure, has built iStumbler for iOS. He just can't sell it or give it to anyone because, as you said, it uses a private API. But you know darn well he has built iStumbler for iOS. I'd say that not because he told us he has, but because Alf knows what he's doing and he used to work at Apple. And so it stands to reason. Well, it may just be that what Alf built or someone else built is already on your iPhone. If you have Apple's AirPort utility application on your iOS device, you can check the Wi-Fi, all of the Wi-Fi in your area. The first thing you do is install the app. It's free. It's from the App Store, but it's obviously an Apple app. So it gets to do some things that other people can't. Once it's there, go into the Settings app, not into the AirPort utility app. Go into the Settings app and go to AirPort utility and turn on Wi-Fi scanner. Once you've done that, then you launch the AirPort utility app, and up in the upper right hand corner will be a little thing that says, it's in blue. It says Wi-Fi scan. Tap that and then hit right in the same spot. Hit the scan button. It will start showing you a list of all of the different access points it finds, their signal strength, the channel that they're on, everything. It's outstanding. Now, listen, it's not the UI I would like. If third-party developers had access to this, they would make a much prettier layout of it. And, you know, you could have it in six different ways. But this is, I mean, it's way better than nothing. So thank you, Paul, for sharing.
Yeah.
That. Super excited about this.
Oh, so what you mean to tell me is that because Apple is writing this, they can access the private APIs, but other people can't. Is that what we're getting at here?
That's exactly what I'm telling you. they get to bend the rules. Yeah.
And I was shocked to find this. Yeah. Again, well, Apple can do what they, you know.
Yeah, Paul didn't know about it either. So, he said somebody from Apple showed him, actually. We'll leave it at that. But yeah, it's outstanding.
Yeah, but it's not a secret. So the thing is, you should methodically go through every one of your apps in settings and look for secrets. And so I'm going to charge all of our listeners to do that and tell us about anything cool that they find.
That's a great idea. Seriously, man.
I may do that as well. If I have a couple of days to waste.
Yeah.
Well, not waste, because hey, you don't know what you find, but it's amazing. I mean, it's hidden in plain sight. It's right there.
Right. It's not hidden in there. It's just nobody told us about it. Well, Paul did. So thanks, Paul. That's good. It's crazy.
Awesome.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to Larry. This is interesting. Larry says, I've had a long-standing problem, and I have contacted both Apple and Verizon, each of whom point the fingers at each other. I've come to you as a referee. I am in lovely Irvine, California. I step outside of my door and wonder where the closest bagel shop is. I open Safari out of habit rather than preference and type in bagel into the URL/search bar at the top. Safari then displays the closest 5 results in San Diego, 80 miles away. I've already done the litany of resets, network settings, location and privacy, location services allowed, blah, blah, blah. So I challenge you guys to go deep on this. By the way, one time when I called tech support, it was happening to them as well, but I don't remember if that was Apple's or Verizon's tech support. Any ideas? So I do have an idea. Location is determined using a variety of factors, and depending on the granularity needed by the app in question, you may get it's going to use different sources for location. If you're running a GPS app, it's actually going to light up the GPS circuit on your phone because it knows you want down to the foot, if possible, you know, where you are. But if you're just looking for a bagel shop, it's actually going to try to do as little as it can to figure out your location, because there's no reason to expend all the power and time to light up the GPS circuit that would be required to do that. So there are, in addition to the actual GPS receiver in the phone also triangulates its location from cell towers. That's one way. And then the cheapest of all ways is by looking at the local Wi-Fi hotspots. And now you don't have to be connected to them. It just needs to see them, which we've just proven your phone can, and look their MAC addresses, which are advertised publicly, up in a database. Skyhook is a database that exists, and you can actually plug your own hotspot into that database at Skyhook Wireless. We'll put a link in the show notes there. There are other databases. I think Apple used to use Skyhook, but it doesn't matter. Whatever. Well, maybe it does matter, but whichever one they use, it's possible. Like if I take my router, I have registered all my routers. I have three of them, or all my access points, I should say, in Skyhook. If I took my router and brought it to John's house, it's totally possible that a phone that saw that might think it was in Durham, New Hampshire. I've seen this problem in different cities. There was a time when I was in San Francisco and it thought I was in Austin because the first time I launched one of my my little clear 4G hotspot was in Austin. And for whatever reason, it logged that in some database somewhere. And so now anytime I'm connected to that, I think I'm in Austin. So it's possible that you or a neighbor lived in San Diego and had this, registered the router, or it got registered for you because Google drives their trucks around and registers, and Skyhook does the same thing. So somebody may have registered that and it's just wrong and has yet to be corrected. That would be my best thought there. The question is, does it happen when you go a mile away? That's all I got. I got nothing else.
What's curious to me is that, we're talking about this general service called location services. What is curious to me is this happening? I'm wondering if what's happening is because maybe wherever you happen to be is not within range of enough satellites to give you a good GPS read. So it backs off and says, well, yeah, I can't see, because I think typically most devices have to see three GPS satellites before they're convinced that what they're getting is reasonable.
But the iPhone only has, to my knowledge, only has one GPS receiver in it. So it's never going to see more than one satellite.
No, I understand
at
that.
Time.
But what I'm saying is that, again, from what I've seen, like when I had a GPS, for driving, it has to see three satellites before it says,
you're misunderstanding. The iPhone literally only sees one at a time. The GPS circuit in it is weak in that regard, right? It will not see more than one because it can't. Like the GPS unit that you would have had in your car.
So you're saying
multiple.
So you're saying the iPhone only sees one GPS satellite at a time.
Correct.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Which is
why it uses assisted GPS with cell triangulation and all of that. Is that not right? I would have sworn it only saw one at a time. And that's how Apple explained it. But if I'm wrong on that, I'm wrong.
All right, we'll look into it. My understanding was that a device has to have three satellites visible before it's convinced that a GPS reading is accurate. Otherwise, it's not. We'll look into it.
Yeah.
Or if somebody knows, hey, let us know. But I'm wondering if for whatever reason the GPS reading is indicated as not being accurate, then it falls back to the less accurate Wi-Fi and says,
My guess is it's not even lighting up however many GPS satellites it could see. My guess is it's not lighting up any of them. My guess is it's doing the cheapest thing power wise
and where it's falling back.
Yeah, exactly.
And where brother's saying, I don't know. It's like, all right, well, we got Wi-Fi. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. It takes the cheapest one power wise and goes with it. But yeah, no, this is something I want to research because it doesn't make sense that a GPS unit could know where it was with only one. Right? I mean, how would it possibly know where it was if it could only see one satellite? It's too big of an area. It would need to see, like you said, three to narrow it down. So maybe the iPhone sees three. I know it was limited. Apple explained that it was limited and it had, I thought they had said that it was one. I could be misremembering from WWDC.
I just remember that it was very fun when I used to have a Garmin, or I still have it, but I don't use it because, well, number one, it was a very nice GPS device. I think I abandoned them when they decided to send me an email saying, hey, you want a new map? That'll be $200. And it's like, dude, I already paid like, you know, a couple $100 for this device already. You want to charge me for a map update?
Oh, yeah.
Screw you.
Right.
But the fun part was that it would have a mode that would show graphically, I think it was like a, you know, buried in one of the menus, it would show you all the satellites it was talking to.
Right.
And until it could get a lock on three satellites, it wouldn't work.
Totally.
I think that's just a general practice that, you know, I got to see more than one in order for me to believe what I'm telling you.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. And we're getting some chatter in our chat room that. Oh, well, there's another thing. There's something called AGPS, which I think is assisted GPS. And I think that's what you were talking about.
Right. Right. Yeah. It uses cell towers and it uses everything, right? You know, to get you there as quickly as possible. But yeah, I'd like to know that I'm scratching my head.
I personally have never had a location problem, but like you, Dave, we're in a fairly major city, metro type area.
Irvine, California is pretty major. I mean, yeah, it's more major than either of us. Yeah.
I mean, he may be in the sticks of Irvine. I mean, I suppose there are the sticks in Irvine, or maybe not. I don't know.
I don't know. I've spent some time in Irvine. I don't know that. I mean, I don't think there's any unpopulated areas, but maybe not. I don't know. My guess is it's a Wi-Fi thing. All right, Michael. So we will, if you know more about this GPS stuff and exactly what the iPhone's doing, please let us know. I'd like to make sure, but not only we get that right, but that we inform you folks correctly. And with that, we will move on to Michael. Excellent question. He says, do you guys know how I can make iTunes extras for my home movies? I'm thinking of maybe digitizing my own friends and family analog video and thought it would be nice to add some iTunes extras. And what he's talking about with iTunes extras are the little interactive things that sometimes you can get when you download a movie from iTunes. So I took a look and dug in. And it seems that iTunes extras are a format, essentially kind of like a web archive, XML-ish, that describes what to do with all these extra resources and how to do it. And which is great. It's not entirely helpful, but at least it tells us the path to go down. There is a PDF that Apple publishes called the iTunes Extras Package Specification that tells you exactly all of this stuff. And if you want to read whatever 40 pages it is, that's fine too. It's pretty gory, but there's some good stuff there. Digging a little deeper though, I found an app at macOS10automation.com/services/iTunes Extra, and it is called Create an iTunes Photo Extra. And it is a nice graphical interface for creating this interactive photo that would start at the beginning of your movie. So we will put links to all of that in the show notes, and hopefully that helps. I didn't realize that these were things that when I started researching, I kind of assumed it was, you know, Apple did this on their own and told no one else how to do it. But that, in fact, is not the case at all. So you too can create them. And in fact, with this little app, you can create them fairly easily. So there you go. That's what I got. Should we go to Francis here, John? Blazing through these here.
Settle.
Lighten up, Francis.
I'm sorry. Francis has to lighten up.
Right. Beavis has to settle down.
Reference.
That's right. Yeah, no, it's a, yes, a Stripes reference. Yeah, that's right. It's one of my favorite things to say to the kids when they get all crazy. I mean, no offense, Francis. Just the crazy psycho guy. And anyway. Francis writes, I have a simple question. Currently, I have ripped all my CDs and other things like training videos I bought from Mac Pro Video and Groove 3 onto a hard drive on my Mac running through iTunes. My monitors connected to my Mac are small active studio monitors I use for making music through Logic Pro, so they sound quite good for listening to audio and podcasts. However, I have even nicer speakers in my room, which hardly get a workout these days except to watch TV. What I'd like to do is listen to what's in iTunes through my much larger speakers. Those speakers are connected to a Yamaha receiver, which has a few HDMI inputs and, apparently, a Bluetooth receiver. Apart from connecting a cable from my Mac to the receiver and trying not to trip over it all the time, is there a Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, or other solution to this that I can use to listen through my better speakers? So yeah, if your receiver or amplifier in this case, I mean, it's both, but if your amplifier has Bluetooth capability in it already, you should be able to pair your Mac with it. You probably will need to put your receiver into Bluetooth pairing mode, and that's going to require looking in the manual and seeing exactly what steps you take to put it into discovery mode. And once it's discoverable, you open up system preferences on your Mac, you go to Bluetooth, and in theory it will appear, and then you kind of go through the pairing process, and it will connect as an audio device. Once it's connected, you can then choose it again, system preferences, go to sound, and choose it as the output device. I don't know, it was a little weird hiccup. I should stop messing around with sound system preferences while I'm doing the podcast here. You can still hear me, right, John?
Hello?
Hello. Yeah, all right, great.
Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi. So, thanks. if you don't want to mess around in sound system preferences, though, you can, and if you have the volume in the menu bar, you can option click on the volume and you will see you get a list of output devices and input devices. And there's a checkbox by the one that's chosen. So you would choose your Yamaha receiver because that's what you're using. And then it would just send the sound there. You could also do this with an AirPort Express. The AirPort Express adds, because it does it over Wi-Fi, you would plug your AirPort Express then into one of the open input channels on your Yamaha receiver. And that's totally doable. The digital audio converter in the AirPort Express is okay. It's adequate for probably 99, maybe 90% of the folks out there. If you have nice speakers and you're picky about this stuff, though, you may not be entirely pleased with the quality you get by going through the AirPort Express. It all depends on what your source material is. With that in mind, I'll rewind back a little bit to, I believe, show 532, when I mentioned the Audio Engine B1. That is a Bluetooth receiver that you would then connect to your Yamaha receiver. And in your case, your Yamaha receiver probably has a decent codec in it. So, a decent converter in it. So you're probably okay, but if you didn't have that, you could use the Audio Engine B1, and that's got a very nice DAC in it to digital audio converter digital to analog converter rather to get the signal back to your receiver. So any one of those would work, but it sounds like you probably already own the hardware inside your Yamaha receiver to do this. It should work great. And you'll probably get some really nice sound out of it. That's my thought. The one thing I will mention about USB audio, and I kind of alluded to this in 532, sorry, not USB, Bluetooth audio, is there is a standard called APTX that effectively gets close to sending CD quality audio over Bluetooth. The iPhone does not support it, but the Mac does. And like I said, my 2007 iMac here in the studio does. So chances are whatever Mac you're using will support that. And that'll send really high quality stuff. The receiver needs to support it. The B1 does. I don't know about your Yamaha receiver, but you can see it in the Bluetooth menu in the menu bar, whether it's connected using APTX. And if it is, then you know it's sending high quality audio over. So there you go. That's what I got, John. What do you got?
It's good.
It is good.
I'm glad you have that, Dave.
I know.
I'm annoyed. Bluetooth annoys me.
Why?
For the most part. And that the Bluetooth devices that I have don't connect to my phone on a reliable basis. I just don't get it.
Seriously. What?
I got this iFit thing, and every now and then I got to cycle power on it, and they say, maybe a thing with the phone. So if it doesn't sync, then you should turn the sync on and off on the device.
Blah, blah,
blah. And same with the tracker device I have, you know, this location device. Another thing, it all seems to be centered around the iPhone. Now, I don't know if it's the iPhone Bluetooth or the device implementation or maybe a little of both.
Yeah.
But I've never been very happy. On the other hand, you know, the audio solutions that I have, that whether it be my HEOS or my AirPort Express.
Neither of which are Bluetooth.
Wi-Fi.
Right. Yeah, right.
No, they're not. No, they're Wi-Fi.
Right. And they work
you said
for
Bluetooth.
No, I said neither of which are Bluetooth.
Ah, right. Okay. Sorry, missed that part.
Yeah.
But yeah, Wi-Fi is great for audio streaming. Just love it. Yeah. And the Apple TV, same thing. If I want to crank music through my Apple TV by Wi-Fi, cranking. Awesome.
Yeah. So, with the exception that the DAC in Apple's devices, the Apple TV included, is not stellar. If you want audiophile quality stuff,
yeah, last
it's not
time you
happen.
Were here, you were being all you were being all picky. You were like, the HEOS doesn't do this and that. And I was like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
No.
Well,
you have a finer ear than I do. For me, it does the job.
You know, we're going to talk about this in a future show. But
yeah.
No. Not the HEOS thing. But these
audio
people
quality thing.
Yeah. People that think there are actually people out there that but like to believe pseudoscience. Yes, I'm being incendiary, but I'm also being truthful.
Go.
That believe that audio encoded at 24 bits and 192K is better to the human ear than audio encoded at 16 bits and 44.1K. And it's not true. The human ear cannot hear the difference of like 16. The reason we have CD quality, quote unquote, CD quality set at 16 bit and 44.1 kilohertz is because that is the best the human ear can hear. And listen, when recording, it makes perfect sense to record at 24 bit and a higher sample rate. Because you're going to, you know, after you record, you're going to post process and chunk stuff out. So it makes perfect sense to, you know, start with more than you need so that when you cut it all down, you don't have less than you want. Right. But it's crazy to think that then encoding it at 24 bits is going to make a difference. It doesn't. There might be some argument like the Audio Engine B1 has a 24 bit converter in it, and it will upsample. And there is some argument that says having a DAC sending a 16 bit signal to a 24 bit DAC might actually be a good thing, because if you have a 16 bit DAC, it could, if it's not the highest quality DAC, you might wind up losing something in the conversion there. But when they've done blind AB testing on this, it comes out that it's less. Like less than 50% of the people, or less than 50% of the time, people are right, which means it's worse than guessing whether you can tell the difference between 16 bit and 24 bit. I don't know.
Yeah.
I rant about this a lot.
Yeah.
So I'm going to move on now.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
No. All I know is that, yeah, when you listen to the HEOS, you identified certain imperfections that were imperceptible to me. But then that's me and that's you.
My problem with the HEOS was not the quality of the sound.
The reproduction at certain frequencies, I think, was or the projection was
the projection.
It was not to your liking.
It was weird.
I get it.
If you changed your height in the room, things got weird. It was like really good when I was in the floor, and it
sucked
when I stood up.
You're the wrong height.
That's the problem.
Yeah, the problem is you're the wrong height.
That's the problem.
You're the wrong customer.
Right.
For this product.
Yeah.
Now, things that really get me, and then we'll get back on track, is articles that talk about cabling affecting sound quality. Those are endlessly hilarious. And you've seen some of these, you know, voodoo things like, well, you got to get our, you know, super enhanced copper. No, cables are cables, whether it be USB or audio, for the most part. And no. I remember I saw a study.
Really? If you have, if you have cheap quality cables, you're going to get bad sound through them.
And all right. But I saw a study where they used a wire hanger as a transmitter for sound information versus a monster cable. And most people couldn't tell, or I think everybody. I don't know. So for analog sound, perhaps for digital sound, I would say, you know, just like HDMI, it's like, all right. So you're saying that a cable sending digital information that you have to get a certain level of quality. It has to be a really bad cable to send digital info and not work
for
right.
digital
like
stuff
and stuff like that.
Good is good enough. Right. Absolutely. But I will mention that
analog. Okay.
Sound is analog. Right. So at some point in the chain,
yes,
it's going to get converted to analog. And again, even there, I would argue that good is good enough. Right. You just don't want to have breaks in the cable. You don't want to have extra resistance.
Sure.
That kind of thing. Yeah. But yeah. No, you don't need to go spend thousands of dollars on cable.
The right impedance and, you know, right impedance and right, you know.
Right.
All right. And yeah, as we got from the room here, I think we all know this, monster cables are way overpriced for the most part. I think we can all agree on that.
if you need good quality cables, buy them from Monoprice. I have been really impressed, like, with the roadworthiness of their cables, their quarter inch and their XLRs. It's fantastic. This stuff lasts.
For audio.
Yeah.
For audio, because I go to them by network.
And for digital. Right. Yeah.
And every network cable I got from them is stellar. Some of their equipment is kind of, I haven't had wonderful results. But, you know, we're way off track. So we got to get back on track, Dave. And I think Greg is going to bring us back on track. What do you think?
Yeah, take it. Yeah, we'll wrap up with Greg.
Okay, great. So Greg writes in and says, hi, John and Dave. As you know, Aperture is going bye-bye. And yes, we know that. So the thing is, for those of you who don't know this, so Aperture is Apple's professional photo management solution. iPhoto is their freebie photo management solution, and they both work under Yosemite. But the problem is they will not work, or so they say, that those products are both end of life. Apple will come up with a new product. And so the dilemma here is... Greg says, I have a client that wants to migrate from Aperture and iPhoto to Lightroom. And they have a terabyte of raw photos. Wow. I thought I was bad. My library, personally, Dave, is on the order of hundreds of gigabytes, but not a terabyte. So, oh my goodness, that's a lot. I understand in the latest version, you can now import from Lightroom, from Aperture to Lightroom. Have you tried this? And if so, how well does it work? I found that when I tried to import photos to Lightroom from the import from iPhoto file menu, that it made folders with a ton of different dates on the left of the Lightroom UI. Also, the client travels a lot and also has an iMac and a laptop. They mainly use the iMac at home. They want to be able to access the same Lightroom catalog on the iMac and laptop. I know that you can do smart previews, but if they have that on the iMac, then switch to the laptop, they won't be available. Lightroom Mobile is cool, but that's iPad and iPhone. Can we put the photos on a server to access and access from anywhere? If the catalog is one computer and updates the catalog, how can I use one catalog on both Macs? Basically, they want to use Lightroom from anywhere and leave the photos in one place. So if they switch from the iMac to the laptop and move it in the other room or goes on a trip, they can access them from there. Any suggestions would be appreciated. Thank you and wish you best in 2015. Likewise. So, did some digging here. So I actually tried the Lightroom trial a while ago and I got kind of the same experience and that it kind of munged a lot of the metadata or the important stuff for a lot of us. You know, when you get your photos in with any package, whether it be Aperture, iPhoto, Lightroom, you typically do kind of neat things like name them or create albums or other organization. And last I tried the Lightroom import, it kind of mess things up as was indicated. So first off, The good news is that you can get a free trial, or last I checked, you can. We will link to a URL that lets you check out their 30-day free trial. The good news is that I saw a recent article in, guess where? Adobe has a blog where they talk about kind of new interesting things that they are doing with their product. And hey, they just apparently came out around October with a Aperture import plugin. I believe it's also for iPhoto. And they indicate specifically, because I think there were problems in the past here, they indicate specifically, here is the metadata that we will import and here's the metadata that we will not. And it looks to cover the metadata that Greg was concerned about. So, good news. And to address the third point, now this, I'm not a Lightroom type of guy. I believe some people in our chat room, like I think our good friend Kenny there. Hi, Kenny. Maybe you could give us a follow-up on this. But apparently Lightroom's strategy is that they have something called a catalog file that links to your photo library. And I found something in their support database as well that said, hey, if you want to access your library from multiple locations, you got to take your catalog file and kind of bring it with you. Now, how could you do this, you may ask? Well, gee, and they even suggest this. Well, hey, how about putting it on a flash drive or a portable drive? And to me, so again, I don't use their product. I use Aperture, but it sounds like to me, they've addressed this. And if you want to go to multiple locations and access your library in a central location, make sure you have your catalog file with you. And to me, that doesn't sound too tough.
Yeah.
I think that's it.
Yeah. So that makes sense.
Personally, you asked me, Dave, I'm waiting. So I'm still on Aperture. I have a single library in a single location. With a lot of programs, it's a concern. You know, how do you manage this? And I think, you know, we've addressed this in the past. Like, say I wanted to access my Aperture library from remote or local. It sounds like Adobe's put a bit of thought into this and came out with this strategy. But for a lot of programs, you got to be careful. You could put it on a server or a NAS and have a VPN or network access. But you got to be careful, I think, especially not so much reading, but once you start opening up a photo library, music library, any sort of library to multiple users, you got to be very careful about what you do. A lot of programs will warn you, hey, dude, there's multiple people. But especially, you don't want to have multiple people writing. Reading, I think, is probably okay. But writing, if you have multiple people updating something, then I think that's just a recipe for disaster.
Well, it depends. I mean, if it's built to be multi-user, it works great. Right. I mean, you know, you and I both use multi-user databases that work fine.
Yeah. But like, for example, I don't know if Aperture. So say I had my library on my NAS and I access. I haven't tried it. And I don't know if it.
No, that's not built to be multi-user. Yeah. No, that's dangerous as all get out. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So the thing is, say I had one user accessing it from remote via VPN and I was accessing it local and we both started adding photos. I think, like I said, that'd be a recipe for disaster.
Totally. I just wanted to, I didn't want it to be overly general advice. I mean, if something's built to be multi-user, by all means, you know, that's how it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I heard. Oh, let's see if we get
that, Dave, here. I hear the clock ticking, you know, it's ticking. Yeah. We're almost at the end of 2014, and then we got this 2015 thing. I mean, what's up with that?
It's going to be an odd year.
Whose idea was this?
Get that? It's going to be an odd year. Oh, yeah, there you go.
Even I get that.
Oh, my gosh. Wow, we got to get out of here fast.
Yeah, that was even worse.
That's okay, even worse.
Stop.
Primarily, though. Okay, never mind. Feedback at MacGeekGab.com is the email address that you can write to. Right, John?
I don't know about that. Is this episode prime? I don't know, but All I know is that if you want to reach us, it is feedback@MacGeekGab.com.
This could be a prime episode. 533.
You have to ask Dan.
It doesn't, yeah, it doesn't pass any of the quick, you know, not prime tests, but that doesn't mean it's not prime. It's tougher and tougher as things move forward. Yeah, it could be, though. Feedback at MacGeekGab.com is the address to send in your answers about whether or not this episode was prime. And, of course, any questions and tips and cool stuff found and all of that. The next show will be on Friday, I believe, because I'm leaving for CES on Saturday. And I think because of that, I'm actually not going to have Michael convert this one to AAC. I'm going to release both of them just so we can get both shows out, so we can get the main feed out right away. And then we will resume AAC on Friday, just because we've got a short window CES. Between the two. International CES is what they say.
May the Lord have mercy upon your soul.
I know. I'm also going to the Storage Visions conference, but which happens this weekend down in Vegas. God,
you like punishment.
I know. Should be fun.
I looked at it. Maybe next year I'll do it. But dude, I mean, the show's insane.
Yeah.
How can you focus? Well, I know how you focus.
Oh, my schedule has been built for 2 weeks. Yeah, no, it's I'm very, very focused.
Pre-plan. You got pre-plan.
You have to. You have to. Yeah, I spend as little time on the show floor as possible.
You will be lost in a sea of technology, and there will be no escape.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Yes, this coming Friday, January 2nd, I believe, is the day that we're planning on doing the show next. So, all right. Yeah. Did I say 206-666-GEEK was the number that you can call, John?
I don't think you did, and I didn't say 4335.
That's right. And Google Plus, come visit us over there. We just broke 700 people on our. I think Dr. Bob actually was number 700 to join the Google Plus community, but we're well above that now. That's it.
Mac, not a real doctor.
No, that's right. That's let's see. It's MacGeekGab.com/Google+ is the best way to get there. I do want to thank Michael Johnston, not for converting this show, but that's my decision. I just want to get it out, so we'll have both of them out shortly here. But he converts everything else to AAC for us and for you, and I know you and we appreciate that. So thank you, Michael. He is the host of the iOS show, a fantastic podcast that I recommend you check out. Also, thanks to the folks at Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com, for providing all the bandwidth. And of course, the podcast marketplace does include Lynda, as we mentioned, lynda.com/MGG to get 10 days free. Also, barebones.com, smilesoftware.com, gazelle.com, squarespace.com/MGG, and of course, Drobo. I believe the coupon code MGG. I think the other $90 off coupon code is gone, but MGG50 will get you $50 off. So check that out too. Happy New Year, folks. Happy New Year, John. And John, do you have any final lasting advice for us to as we wrap up the year here?
Well, especially to avoid New Year's Eve shenanigans, especially if you have a refreshing beverage or two, be careful. Because you don't want people to pile things on top of you or draw on you, because that means that you've got caught.
Made up.